Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the Beer Ladies podcast with your hosts, Lisa, Katie, Christina, and myself, Tandy. You can find us at our website or all over social media. Our website is beerladiespodcast.com, and our social media, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, Blue Sky, TikTok, and even Facebook are at Beer Ladies Pod or Beer Ladies Podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can find our merch store link on any of our social media bios or in the show notes for this episode. And if you'd like to sponsor an episode, do mail us at beerladiespodcast@gmail.com. Now back to the beer.
Hello, and welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. I am Lisa, and I am your host this evening, and I am joined by my charming and erudite co-host, Christina. Hello, Christina. Christina is waving. And we are very, very excited to have someone on to talk to us not about beer. I know it's shocking, but instead, we are going to be talking perry, cider, all of those good things, but you know, we're still keeping on brand. We still have an Irishman to talk about these things, although not in Ireland. So all will be revealed, but I want to say a big thank you to, and hello to Barry Masterson. Hello, Barry.
Hello, and thanks for having me. It's a great honor to be here.
Thank you so much. We're thrilled to have you. We're going to dive into all sorts of things, cider and perry, and for those who are wondering what even is perry, we'll get to that. Don't worry. But as per usual, as per tradition, we're going to start out with, what are you drinking? And Christina, I feel like I know, and those at home, like who may be wagering on it, but what have you got for us tonight?
Well, I got the mug, lads.
She's got the mug.
And the tea.
It's a pretty big mug.
We love this mug. I feel like it's become one of the podcast in a way.
It's my favorite thing, you know, because Halloween is a state of mind and it is year round. And so this is my skull mug and I'm upset.
Absolutely.
But yes, tea.
It's on our socials. People have seen it and it's a wonderful thing. So we'll certainly put up more photos of it. So over to you, Barry. What have you got tonight?
Well, as I knew we were probably going to talk about perry, I cracked open something very special for me because as I'm over in Germany, I don't really get access to very many Irish products. But I opened a bottle of perry from the cider mill in Slane, made by Mark Jenkinson. And I'm not sure what year is on this, but I know it's the older version. But yeah, a very, very nice perry made with French pears grown in Ireland.
Oh, I did not know they were French pears. Oh, very exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, and I will say I have yay the same, but in a different bottle. So perhaps mine is slightly newer, but yes, perry, it's just called perry on mine. So it's literally what it says on the tin or bottle in this case, and from the cider mill Slane on the back. So excited to try it because I don't know if I have ever even tried a perry. I've certainly as a student drank a lot of cider, but we won't get into that. There's poor decisions in there, but I think we'll probably start with perry. Barry, what is perry? Tell us all about it.
Well, perry, God, I guess think of it in the way of cider is made from apples, wine is made from grapes, perry is made from pears. And I guess Mark put a really useful clue on the bottle because
yes.
He's changed his normal logo shape into a pear-shaped logo.
Right.
But yeah, it's made from pears. Normally what they call perry pears, which is a type of pear that is generally inedible. So they're really very rich in tannins, and if you bite into it, you get these kind of very, in German they say pelzig. It means
Oh,
like,
that's a good word.
it's a really good word, which means like a furry feeling on your tongue. So
Oh.
it's astringent and kind of sucks your cheeks in, very
Oh.
tannic and dry. But they make, when they're fermented, they make the most amazing drinks, I think, in the world.
Right. And so, and I'm sure we're going to get into this a little bit because I know enough about apples that you would use for cider to be dangerous, not in depth, but I have, Pete Brown's the apple orchard behind me, and so much of that is about the sort of heritage varieties and grafting and all these sort of complicated things, and the very few places in the world that are really trying to maintain some of these varieties. But I guess with on the pear side, there's probably even fewer than there are for the apples. So
Far, far fewer. I mean, Perry is a an older cider, if not older, but it's pretty much disappeared from across Europe. So I think really it's the West Counties of England, France, Normandy, the Domfront region, and Austria, the Mostviertel, they call it, which still have a living tradition of making Perry and these big old trees. Switzerland used to have an amazing Perry culture for hundreds of years, but it disappeared in the past 80 years or so.
Oh.
Germany also had a pretty big Perry culture, and so I live in rural Germany in a very small village, and we're surrounded by these big old Perry pear trees, and nobody was using them.
Right.
So zoinks. I was lucky enough to be able to get access to about 60 or more of these trees. I've mapped over 200 just surrounding the village,
Oh, okay.
and they
That's really
range
cool.
in age from like 80 years to, one of them is probably around 200 years old. But Perry pear trees are remarkable because they live for so long, so up to 300 years or more. And we've got some around here, they're 14 or 15 meters tall.
Oh, my
Don't
goodness.
know what that is in feet. And they're enormous trees, so they're imposing. So Landschaftprägend, as they say in German, they really just bless the landscape, really impressive looking trees that you see in the landscape. And in April when they're flowering, just amazing.
Oh gosh, that sounds beautiful. And
You can
now that
tell I
you
like peri
say
peri
that,
trees, don't you?
oh hey, absolutely. It's funny that now that you say that, I can remember seeing Perry on a couple of menus in Vienna, like in Austria. I feel like there were it did at least pop up in some places. I don't think I got around to trying any, and I don't know how traditional or local any of the ones that were on offer were, but it's good to know there is some kind of at least nod to tradition maybe that they were drawing on.
Oh,
But
definitely. I mean, so the Mostviertel, they live and breathe that culture. I think it
oh,
nearly
wow.
disappeared, and but I think I haven't been there yet, but I know from reports and seeing photos of some of the events around there, there's just pear decorations on buildings and pear
Right.
sculptures, and but it's just in this small region. So the
Okay.
Mostviertel, so Most is the German word for cider or Perry. It's kind of a generic use word. So it's basically the Perry quarter of Austria.
Oh, who knew? That's
Yeah.
amazing. Cool.
So that shows how important it was, and still is, I guess, in that region at least.
Yeah. Oh, I'm always fascinated by these things that are preserved in the language that,
Yeah,
may,
place names are amazing. Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, sorry, Christina, go ahead.
No, I'm just curious. What came first, the trees or the Perry for you? Were you into Perry and then you saw these trees and you were, oh my gosh, I have moved to the best place ever? Or I've, how which way around did that go?
Well, I started making cider. Well, if you go right back, I started making beer. So I was a home brewer, you might know. So I was heavily involved in the beginning of Björn, for example. But I had already left Ireland at that stage. But I had continued brewing as a home brewer, and that was also a kind of a good way to to get in with the locals
Right.
in a small village. This Irish guy coming and making beer, and it was a good way to a social lubricant, let's say.
Yeah.
But it was by accident I kind of fell into making cider. So liking fermenting things, we had bought the harvest rights to a few trees from the local council for the princely sum of 10 euro. Every year they used to basically sell off the harvest rights for certain trees, and it was always the same old people would turn up every year because they wanted to make their most. Or lots of people have apple trees around here and they make juice, and that's what we wanted to do. So we bought the for 10 euro the rights to like a dozen or so trees for that year. And we picked them and we brought them to a mobile press that comes
in
the village in autumn. And that was 2012. And then we had all, and they pasteurize it and they put it into a bag and box. So you have your juice for the year and it's fantastic. But I don't drink that much apple juice. And as a home brewer, I was kind of like, I could ferment that as well, couldn't I? So that was the beginning. And I made a really awful cider. But I don't give up easily and I kept trying. Yeah. So for years, I was just making cider, very small amounts. And then we bought a small orchard with 30 trees in 2015. And then we bought another plot. We tripled the size of the plot and then we doubled it again. So now we've got like 150 apple trees that were planted in the late 50s. So I was doing all that and learning and improving and trying to get better. And I always blame the dog for the Perry. this apocryphal tale, but it's true. So we adopted a dog from Ireland, in fact, from Galway. So from Madra, basically they're a home for dogs in Galway. And they have a sister organization in the west of Germany. That would basically bring dogs over if they can find somebody to adopt them. So, because my wife always had a border collie, so she lived in Galway, she always wanted to have a border collie again. I mean, long story short, Anu came over. We called her Anu after the Irish goddess. And then I started walking routes around the village that I'd never really walked before. So leaving the roadways, leaving the tracks and going across fields and... It was then I started noticing these pears lying in the ground and I was like, what are they doing there? You know, what are they used for? And nobody was using them. And then the more I looked, the more trees I saw. And then I started mapping them because my background is in surveying. And this became like a side quest. So every time we went to walk, we were looking for pear trees and then going further afield and further afield. And eventually, I can't remember what year, I think it was 2019, we started pressing Perry, and that was the year that we registered as a farm and were able to actually sell our produce. And I started then making Perry, and what was coming out was just so mind-altering compared to the ciders, because it was just so different. It was just so different to anything I'd had before. And then I started getting really into researching the Perry culture of Europe and the trees. So I'm also in the Pomologist Association here. So, you know, learning about the fruit varieties and the history of them and how to identify them and stuff like this is like you never stop learning. So this for me became an obsession, to be frank, an absolute obsession to the point that, I'm grafting also these rare or endangered varieties. We're planting a new orchard just dedicated to rare varieties and trying to use the pears that we get access to make something that's interesting, tasty, but also as a kind of a way of conservation through use, I like to say.
Yeah.
That if I can show a farmer, this is a Bayerische Weinbier in a single variety Perry. This came from your trees. Please don't cut them down.
Right.
You know, and if they try, they're like their minds are blown that these inedible pears that they kind of think are useless, can make something that's just so tasty, really.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. And I love that idea of the conservation through use. And we could see that with some local buildings if we just use them. But anyway, that's an aesthetic. But I was saying, I don't think I've ever really had one before, but the more I'm getting into it, the more it is quite different from a cider. It's, there's some sort of superficial similarities, but that it's definitely a different, obviously a different fruit, but different kind of flavor, feeling, mouthfeel, all of those things. But it's interesting how different it would be. So I'm curious about all the different varieties and how they play a role in the flavor.
I was just going to ask you, what does it taste like? Describe what you're drinking.
Well, we've got different vintages. I don't know what year this one was made, but I presume the varieties are going to be the same. So I know from talking with Mark recently that the main variety he's using is a French variety called Plante Blanc, which is a really important variety in the Domfront region. So they have an AOP that defines exactly what should be in this appellation in the for the Perrys
yeah.
made in that region. And it must be, I think it's 40%. All of the Perrys made in that region must be 40% of this Plante Blanc variety. So I was amazed that they're growing in Ireland. I didn't know this
until yeah.
literally this week. but it's really fruity.
Yeah, it's very
mine
fruity.
Has like elements of strawberry jam, and it's not very tannic. You get some that give this kind of grippy bite to it, like something like a really heavy wine, you might get really rich tannins. This one's kind of light on the tannins, but it's got a bright acidity. It's kind of like a little marmalade-y, maybe a little bit of lemon zest, perhaps.
Yeah, I was thinking a little bit of lemon as well with this one, which again looks, maybe it's slightly newer, but it's definitely newer. Yeah, and you know, looking at the bottle too, you know how it says, you know, great with strong cheese, and that was my immediate first thought was, oh, this would really pair with you know, a really good cheese. That would be a, you know, kind of a really nice balance. So yeah.
Same label, I think, same back label.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is interesting though. It's quite dry, but like it doesn't quite have that same. Yeah, I guess that tannic bit that you would get from the apples, you don't get that with the, or at least with this Perry, it's a slightly different, but still get a sort of sparkly kind of thing with it. So
yeah, the tannins kind of act differently between pears and apples. So I have to say the apple varieties we have in Germany have no tannins.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
yeah,
fascinating.
So that's another difference between, so going back to cider, one of the main differences, so in around Frankfurt, they call it apple wine, so apple wine.
Right.
They call it moscht, apple moscht. And that's in the local dialect, apple must. but the varieties here tend to be what we might consider dessert fruit. They're more acid led, whereas in England, in the West Counties, in France and Ireland as well, the apple varieties used there tend to be like what they call bittersweets that would have more tannin. And then you get bitter sharps, whatever, that are lots of tannin, lots of acid, and then sharps that are lots of acid. So there's a whole range in the apples, and pears kind of reflect that as well. But the, like I said, the varieties here and of apples tend not to have tannins. I think in Austria it's similar, and probably Switzerland as well, and northern Spain to a degree, and in the east counties of England as well, Kent around there, they have more acid-led apples, I'd say. But the pear varieties across Europe tend to share big tannins. Some more, some less, some that have more acid, some that have less acid. So there's a whole range that you can work with. So for me, working with something that's really heavily tannic is a joy, because the apples don't have that. And traditionally, here, because the apples don't have it, to make up for that and to help clarify or add body or structure, it was very traditional in this region of Germany to add peri pears into the press with the apple and tannin.
Oh, fascinating. That makes sense, though. And I did wonder, too, just, you know, noticing that on the bottle here, where it says it's, you know, it's 100% pressed fresh fruit. And I wondered, is it all going to be all pears, or is there going to be a combination, or maybe it depends on what you're making.
So this is 100% pears.
Mm.
The distinction Mark is making there is that his products are what over here we refer to as orchard based. I think in the US they call harvest based, which I think is a really lovely term, because it really reflects the methods used by small makers, where it is harvest based. You get one chance a year to make a product. You press the fruit fresh. You might store it for a bit to get ultimate ripeness, but there's no concentrate, there's no sugars, there's no corn syrup.
All right, that makes sense.
And
yeah.
You press it once a year, whereas the Magners of the world, they're pressing, they're using concentrate basically throughout.
Right.
So they're producing a consistent product throughout the year. You use concentrate, water, corn syrup, and that type of thing. So this is why you'll also get a lot more variation with these smaller
makers.
And I think it's a lot more fun. And it's, like I said, one chance a year. So when he says it's fresh juice, you know, it's been pressed by him, it's been fermented by him, and it's one chance a year. And what, he only made 1,000 liters or something.
Yeah. And I think that's nice, like you say, where you have that sense of, this is an agricultural product, which you can sometimes lose that in a sort of mass market variety.
Yeah.
And again, whether that's like a Magners, I'm thinking of, you know, the things I would have had as a student that came in a plastic bottle, or you know, that kind of.
You're not the only one. Yeah, my conception of cider was very different until I started making it. So I was a complete beer person, like totally focused on beer, and you know, drink everything and travel and you know what it's like.
Right.
But my cider worldview was very limited by what I had drank, and it's the same for lots of people. You know, as a teenager, drinking 2 liters of Strongbow type of thing, and you know pints of Bulmers or Magners in summertime, and you know, that's fine. It's nothing wrong with it. I quite fancy a 2 liter of Strongbow again. but there's a lot more to discover, and I think as beer geeks, for me, it was totally eye opening to uncover this whole different kind of parallel universe of cider making. That is, you know, an agricultural product, and these small makers, and it's just a joy to visit them and see what they're doing, and some very creative people.
Oh, and speaking of creativity, and this may be a complete sidebar, but again, it sort of reminded me, you know, in Pete Brown's book, he talks about, I think he opens the book where he goes to kind of a wassailing sort of ritual. I wonder, are there similar local sort of, and again, ritual may be a heavy word, but it, you know, are there some sort of fun activities, if you like, around kind of either the harvest or planting that are all sort of associated with the with the apples and the pears in Germany, or are these kind of all, I don't know.
No, there isn't.
Oh, that's too bad. Like, maybe you should start one. That could be fun. Yeah.
So I've seen in the US, there's lots of cideries exactly doing wassailing. Where they light fires and they go on a procession out into the orchard and sing songs and dance and hang pieces of toast on the trees and do a libation. So the libation is something I'm very much into.
giving
the trees a drink of their own produce to it.
Well, I'm always of the opinion you can start a tradition anytime. So, you know,
maybe.
There you go. Free consulting
I've been thinking about it. I've been thinking about it. I know our neighbors would definitely be into it. So last time we did go for a walk at nighttime, or just as at sunset, and we went up the hill behind our house and we visited some pear trees and we drank the perry that was made from those trees.
Oh, that's nice.
And then it got dark and they were shining their torches up through the trees, and it was really nice. I thought, if I ever start doing tours and tastings, I'm going to do that.
Definitely. And tell people, they've done this for thousands of years. There's unbroken tradition.
It's an old Irish tradition, Take out your phone torch and shine it.
Right. I feel like there's a lot of scope for potential dressing up and dress the dog up and, you know,
I don't think she'd like that.
back to kind of, you know, on, you know, sort of what I guess... And Christina, you may want to get in on this as well. Like, if you're looking for perry, like, how do you know if it's a good perry? Good, obviously, is subjective, but what makes it, you know, not the Strongbow of perry, I guess?
So, is perry the drink?
Yeah, just in general. Yeah.
That's a really difficult question.
And that's okay. There may not be one answer. So.
No, I don't think there is, because everything is so, you know, your own personal taste is so... Mm-hmm. So it's subjective. You cannot say everything will fit. Well, there are perries that will appeal to everybody. So my wife, for example, she used to be a Guinness drinker, and then she kind of got out of drinking alcohol, and she doesn't drink beer anymore, and she doesn't like cider at all, but she'll drink a perry.
Interesting.
Because so the ciders we make are dry, they're bone dry,
right?
No residual sugar whatsoever. But perry, even when it ferments completely fully and won't ferment anymore, there will always be a little bit of residual sugar because of sorbitol. It's an unfermented.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
But this also gives a little, just a slightly off dry edge to most. And sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. And I think that takes the edge, that scratchy note that you might get with, if it was completely dry, it might be a little bit too scratchy on the throat if it's a very tannic one. But I can't give an answer to that, because there are so many types of pears that will yield so many ranges of flavor. You just have to try.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, there we go. There's a, you know, a sort of assignment for everyone. Just go try them.
So like I said, I only know of three Irish perries, but I'm sure there are you know, retailers in Ireland who might have the likes of cider from Ross Cider and Perry Company. in Herefordshire, or from Little Pomona, or Tom Oliver, and they make fantastic perries.
And is there anything that is kind of like a big commercial perry that is out there, or not so much? Like, would there even be the scale for that?
The first one that would come to mind when I think of like big scale perry is Baby Sham. Do you know Baby Sham?
Oh God, yes. Not. I mean, I haven't had one in a very long time. Oh gosh,
that's
you better.
A perry.
Is it?
What is? What is it?
Good Lord.
The champagne of perry, but I think they're not going to say that anymore. But basically, yeah, they wanted to create a product that was, I think it was in the 1950s, Showerings, I think it was at the time. And yeah, they basically created a champagne alternative. I think they were importing concentrate from Switzerland in the beginning, or at some stage. But they also planted thousands of a variety called Hendry Hufkap, which is a really, really nice perry pear, which again has gone rare again. But yeah, so they made like champagne bowls branded with Baby Sham and Baby Sham, Baby Champagne. Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like it had a big sort of resurgence maybe in the 70s. I think of it as a very sort of 70s product.
I mean, I was a child of the 70s, and I remember my mother having Baby Sham. And I'm pretty sure my first drink was Baby Sham.
Right.
Like as a 4 or 5 year old having a sleep at Christmas type of thing.
Right.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah. And it had the little little deer on it, like the
exactly,
little Bambi deer. Yeah, it was I'm sure it's still out there, but yeah.
I think it's making a comeback because I recently saw a website that had these really bright baby blue hoodies with the Baby Sham.
Oh my goodness.
On the back of them. So I think it's kind of coming back. But that's probably the biggest brand of perry. Between the UK and Ireland that I can think of. But I was encouraging my mother to try and find some again, but she couldn't.
Wow, mind blown. I didn't realize that was a perry, but I guess, but again, like you were saying before, I guess people are using certain varieties. They stay with us. So maybe that's a net good overall. So
I have been firmly living under a rock because I have never heard of Baby Sham.
I don't know that you're missing much.
You need to seek it out. So I would love to try it because I have no memory, but it's just such an iconic brand. I think it's worth just to try.
Yeah, honestly, the branding is worth tracking down just on its own. Like it's kind of thing. Yeah, when you see it at like a charity shop, it is so kitschy and we'll have to go
add
on
it
a hunt.
The rabbit holes of things I need to Google this weekend.
So I mean, the funny thing is, so through history. I mean, cider was often compared with back in the day, like in the 18th or 17th century. And the big houses, the toffs, were always going around each other's houses and kind of trying each other's ciders. And they were very pleased if it was indistinguishable from a wine or something. But there's lots of tales of kind of blind tastings in Germany, in Nuremberg or whatever, where a merchant brought in some perry. Didn't tell them what it was, and then these other wine merchants are trying it and saying, "Oh, it's a Canary wine, or it's a Malaga wine, or something." And that's no, it's a pear wine. So if it's rightly made, it can be very vinous. Let's say
that makes sense, and I've definitely come across some of those articles too. Like you say, especially for Germany, Austria, I can. And again, it was in that sort of framed that way as sort of, someone's kind of putting one over on these guys who think they're very, you know, have fancy palates. But so again, so we've always had that as a, tradition, basically. Yeah. But oh my gosh, that's so interesting. But I guess let's back up a little bit. So how did you get to Germany in the first place? And what was the journey there?
It's my wife's fault. So
we all blame people. Yeah.
She's German. So she... she studied archaeology in Ireland, in Galway. Really? Are you?
Two archaeology degrees here. So.
Oh, wow. And I worked in archaeology then for for 8 years.
So oh, funny. Yeah.
And that's how we met. I worked for the Discovery Program.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was the GIS manager there before I left.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
But yeah, it was always the kind of, should we move over or not? And at the end, she was like 16 years in Ireland.
Right.
And, wanted to be closer to the parents type of thing. So it was either do it or never do it type of thing. And I got a job offer I couldn't understand and decided, well, just screw it. We just leave. And that was 2008.
Right.
And we first lived up in Northern Germany for a couple of years. And then I was allowed to work from home. And we moved closer down Southern Germany, close to where my wife's parents are from.
Yeah.
And bought this house, renovated it. And I guess I'm not going to be moving anywhere else.
That's fair enough. And then you just happen to sort of luck into having these amazing trees around to kind of spark inspiration.
Yeah. So, like I said, it wasn't planned. It was a hobby that went out of control.
Well, we've all got some of those. Yeah.
But I think a good hobby. It keeps me outdoors and an antidote to sitting in an office all day.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Can you talk just a little bit more about the history of Perry? You kind of touched on that, but just a little bit more of the history, particularly in Germany, or anything in history wise you think is particularly like, wow, this is cool, everyone should know about this.
How long do you have?
I mean, I have all day.
Let's say the cleft notes. So I mentioned it has been around a long time. I think some of the earliest records are from the Romans, and I think it was who was it? Now I can't remember.
Like, there's a Pliny the Elder story for everything. There's probably one somewhere.
Palladius.
Okay.
4th or 5th century CE, I think. And he had a book, Opus Agriculturae or something. And he had basically a passage in this mentioning making pear wine.
Mm.
And that's one of the earliest entries. Charlemagne also, when was that? 800 CE, around that time.
Yeah.
He had basically issued a set of rules for how his estate should be run across the Holy Roman Empire. And he specified that every estate should have somebody who knows how to make cider and who knows how to make perry.
Oh, wow.
There you go. So he was interested in cider and perry. Last year, I found some medieval poetry from Austria and Switzerland written in Middle High German.
Oh, wow.
It was really fun to you think you can read it, but I actually had to get a medievalist to really look in, because some of the meanings were just it was hard to get out, plus the the pronunciation, the way they're spelled. So I could almost read it, and I did a rough translation, but she really helped with the deeper meanings and all the double meanings that are in these.
Yeah, I feel like there's all these hidden rhymes and double entendre.
Yes, double entendres.
Yeah.
Because apparently the pair had very many symbolic meanings. So yeah, and then these Minnelead singers, who are basically these courtly bards, and one song, basically the setup was this minstrel was singing for the lady of the house, but his throat was too dry and he was a bit nervous
Oh.
and whatever. And then she calls for a pitcher of birnbaum, so a pear wine, to basically soothe his throat. And they end up kind of in the corner together, nibbling nuts and
As you do. Yeah, one thing
eating
led to
another hair
another.
of hair,
Yeah.
whatever. So yeah, that was really cool, because that was the first kind of description I got of kind of everyday use of Perry. The other one was interesting. I think it was an Austrian. He was writing a pretty scathing song about kind of other lands nearby. So kind of they're all barbaric. And he mentioned the Bohemians, are there kind of guzzling their beer, and the Bavarians let them drink their Perry.
Oh,
That was
shade.
interesting. So that was around 1290, I
Oh,
think.
wow.
And it
Yeah.
basically suggested that
That's cool.
the peasantry of Bavaria, that their main drink was pear wine and cider, probably
Right. Oh, gosh.
before
If some people would
beer took over.
come to blows over
Completely, yeah.
that.
So wrote a small article on cider review about just revealing those stories. But you don't to overinterpret, but it was a little
Right.
window on kind of how Perry was seen in these kind of medieval courts and that type of thing. But I think the golden age of Perry was, well, certainly in Switzerland they were making it. I read stuff from 1529 onwards that Perry was a very important thing in Switzerland. But in England, it was around the early to mid 17th century, that, well, let's say around this time there was lots of wars going on, and the English were importing lots and lots of wine and stuff. And I guess with wars, the 30-year war, and the war with Holland and all this stuff going on, it was getting harder for them to be getting wine in. So the kind of bright minds, the precursors of the Royal Society at the time, were sending letters back and forth, like the ambassador to Switzerland, the English ambassador. It was Cromwell's ambassador, actually. So Charles had gone at that stage. Had been writing back about Swiss Perry, and they were exchanging notes across Europe and this type of thing. But a lot of people in that circle kind of saw cider, and especially Perry, as being a replacement for wine. So basically, to create an English wine. And that was like a golden age, because they were really starting to get into pomology and the more scientific approach to identifying fruit and cultivating fruit and making wines and or ciders and perries out of these fruit. That kind of died away again. I think people still wanted to import their French or their Canary wines anyway
They
when
want to
things
feel
were coming down.
fancy, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was kind of a highlight, and it kind of ebbed, and it kind of waned, and it was kind of sad in a way. And across Europe, like I mentioned, Switzerland was really a big thing and until the 1950s, and then they basically obliterated their entire landscape of trees. 11 million trees were cut down between 1950 and 1970.
Oh, my goodness.
But
Wow.
by then, they'd already forgotten
Horrible.
their periculture. Austria held on to it. Germany lost it. So the Bavarians don't drink Perry anymore.
No.
But there were pockets that survived in the Palatinate, the West Palatinate, which is on the border of Belgium and France, up until around the 1950s again. And again, from the 50s on, I think across Europe, there was a big change with modernization of farming. Around here, so our orchard was planted in this time, where they were basically getting rid of trees that were in the landscape. So they used to practice agroforestry in the past. They planted trees in the tillage, surrounded by grain, and they were harvesting with horses and whatever, so it was easy. But when they started mechanizing, they were in the way. So they rationalized the landscape, got rid of all these things, and planted kind of more compact orchards, that type of thing. But that meant that a lot of the traditions just kind of went by the by. And in places like the West Palatinate, they kind of hung on because it was kind of more rugged landscape or something. And they kind of hung on a bit later than other places. But yeah, there's been highs and lows, but it's like I said, it has such a long history. but it's been forgotten in most of the places where it was made. And yeah. even in England, where they hung on in the West Counties. I think it's a bit of a resurgence now, thanks a lot to people like Adam Wells, who started Cider Review, and who's also publishing a book through Camera about Perry, the first book written dedicated to Perry.
Oh, wow.
Available for pre-order through Camera also.
Available for pre-order through Camera? What?
No, I mean, I've already ordered it, and I'm ordering Christina's book too. So, yeah.
Yay!
It's, just to get that plug in for you too.
Well done. Well done.
So just following up on that, Barry, do you know why, or do you have any idea why Perry sort of fell out of favor?
There's lots of, well, I think I mentioned that in some places. So I know for a fact that in the Palatinate, for example, we mentioned the modernization of agriculture meant that these trees were in the way. But it was also a time where it was, let's say the post-war years here, people were definitely using the things that they had because there was nothing mm-hmm. else. But let's say from the 50s onwards, it seems that it was easier to, you know, buy soft drinks. It was easier to buy beer. So I know some of the old people in our village always said to me, yeah, beer was for Sundays. It was expensive. And right. everybody drank mushed. All the farmers made their own cider, and that's what they drank. In autumn, they made thousands of litres, had it in their mushed cellar, in the cellars, and that's what they drank. The labourers drank during the year. But as kind of, yeah, more, I don't know, it was easier just to get ready-made products, and people just yeah. It was handier, and it just got less and less important. And as the generations went on, the tradition got lost, because it's hard work. It's really hard work to make.
Pattern. Oh yeah,
you know, harvesting alone is hard. Yeah, that's maybe one part of the reason. It's complicated because I think every region has its own micro story. Let's say
right.
The Swiss also. They had been making Perry and it was really famous and exported, and then it seems they turned more to distilling as time went by, and then alcoholism became a problem, and then other ideas kind of took over, that we've got to solve this problem, and we've got to improve fruit growing and blah blah blah. And like I said, they got rid of 11 million trees in 25 years. And any Swiss people I've spoken to, even people who should know, and they're in pomology and stuff, they aren't aware that Perry making was a big tradition there. It's amazing that it's lost from even the cultural memory.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's also like how at the same time you lost all these draft horse breeds because, you know, they weren't used for the day-to-day work anymore. And now some of them still exist as rare breed kind of, you know, sort of small groups of people holding on to it. But again, because I nerd out about that kind of thing, but they go hand in hand, because if you're not harvesting the same way, yeah.
Conservation through use. And if you're not using it, it just gets forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so quickly too. I mean, how there was just a kind of, you know, we just sort of quickly moved on. So I guess it's again, these things that are very much, even with the kind of medieval poetry and songs example, it's this window into the everyday instead of kind of the other, the fancy, and people forget kind of that the everyday. So it's so important to kind of try to pull these things back into the light. So,
well, this is, I mean, as archaeologists and historians, you know what it's like when you're looking through this keyhole, I always say, and you're only seeing small amounts of it. I think one of the, I think beer is easy in a way, and I guess wine to an extent as well, because it was the kind of the ecclesiastical sites where dealing with that stuff in the medieval period, and everything was recorded and it was taxed.
Right.
But it was peasantry, the farmers that were making the cider and the perry, and that was free of tax and it wasn't recorded.
Right.
So, you're only getting
that makes it very complicated.
Really? Yeah. So when you find these little things, so like those medieval songs, it's kind of wow, you know.
Yeah.
Any mention at all is kind of like gold dust, and then you've got another crumb to try and follow to see can you find a little bit more about that region or what it was done. Like the they were taxing the import of Perry in the city of Trier in West Germany, you know, because they wanted to protect the wine trade, so they put a tax on these farmers bringing the perry in, and then people were really pissed off, and they said, "Okay, you can double in the amount."
Just from like a kind of now the wheels are turning, so I'm thinking like just from like a material culture perspective, like there must have been the presses and things like that. Are these the kind of things where maybe they're there and they're just not recognized, or I just wonder how much of it is just that it's just not noticed almost. So
I recently bought a book called the Fruit Mills of the Palatinate. Oh.
As you do, yeah.
And it's not on my desk. But the material culture, there are. So at least in the Palatinate, they use stone for the mills.
Right, which makes sense. Yeah.
Still there. So they have these big circular things with a dome in the middle, and they would have a cross beam across it, and then a big mill wheel, a big round mill wheel that would basically, with a horse or people, roll around this trough, this stone trough. And you find them dotted around the Pfalz or the West Palatinate. Around here, they didn't use that. I don't know what they used. So they did also use wooden troughs,
okay,
stone wheels. So they're long.
Right. Yeah. Good luck. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, at some stage, I guess, when was it? In the 19th century, they started producing kind of, you know, proper mills with gears and kind of grating mechanisms to make it much easier. So, yeah, there's lots of literature. So at least that stuff is in literature. But what they were doing before, these kind of, I don't know, modernization of techniques, is pretty much what they were doing in the Pfalz up till 1950.
Right. Oh, gosh. And maybe that leads on nicely to thinking about these varieties that still exist. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, and also just the literal hard graft, because you have to graft things, and just a little bit about that process. Because I know, again, bits about it, but not enough to know how to do it, if that makes sense, or what would, you know, be involved beyond. I know there are old varieties out there, and you have to kind of coax them back to life.
Yeah, the problem with apples and pears or any of those palm fruits is they don't grow true from seed.
Right.
So if you have a flaky bark pear, so that's a very rare English pear variety, and you've got maybe up to 10 seeds in each pear. They've been cross-pollinated with other varieties. Mm. And every single seed will have a different genetic makeup. So when you plant those seeds, they will not be a flaky bark. They will be a combination of whatever flaky bark and whatever the pollen donor was. So the only way that you can keep a variety going, and what I always find remarkable is that we have varieties that were recorded over 500 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And they still exist because of this process called grafting, as you mentioned. And grafting is basically you take a new shoot from a tree in winter. So right now I'm cutting scions. So they're called scions. So this shoot is referred to as a scion. And you take a scion from a tree of the variety that you want to propagate. And then you basically splice it onto a rootstock. So you've got roots that are growing. And it's basically like a skin graft, I guess, in a way, because that's where the term comes from. You're grafting this scion onto a donor rootstock, and they basically heal together. You'll see a scar, and then it'll grow. And then you've maintained that variety. And people have been doing this for hundreds, actually thousands of years. It's mentioned in the Bible as well. So grafting figs, I think it was. So that's the way you maintain these varieties. And I always, so I'm not a spiritual or religious, so the nearest thing I feel I get to kind of a spiritual experience is grafting these trees and thinking that people have been grafting this piece of, it all came from one tree. At some stage it was one tree.
Right.
Somebody said, that's a really good tree. That makes a really good cider or perry. And they said, I'm going to make more of those. And it's continued on and on for hundreds of years that we still have these really old varieties.
Yeah, that's always been fascinating to me. I know, like, because my in-laws are in Longwood Gardens or near Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania, and they have as Christina will know too, they've got all these old espaliered, sort of trees, and they, you know, some of them they can trace back to sort of 17th-ish century in terms of, you know, part of that, you know, that particular variety. But again, like, they might be older. That's just as far as the records go, and then they keep grafting and keep grafting. So it's fascinating to see. But I know too, it's like, it doesn't always work. So it's, you know, kind of
not always,
just kind of keep at it. But
yeah, it's easier than you might think. So
really interesting.
I think it's just, if you learn the techniques, whatever, and you know what you have to do to make the cambium layer, this layer right under the bark, that's what grows every year, and that's what makes the tree rings. You archaeologists know this. A bit of dendro. But as long as you do your cuts and so that those match up on the rootstock and on the scion, when they match up, and then you bind them together and make sure they're
Okay.
airtight so no water can get in or anything, so it doesn't rot. I keep them tight together. Then the cambium layers meet and they try to heal the wound, basically.
Right.
And then that's it.
Okay.
You've got a new tree.
That's
There's lots
amazing,
of
but
beaks and it's really fun and I really enjoy doing it.
yeah, but then I guess you're waiting a long time for it to get to the size of some of those trees you've got growing around, but
Well, there's an old saying from Hereford, pears for the heirs. So I
right.
started this way too late in life. So it'll be another 15 to 20 years before the pears I've been grafting will bear any amount of fruit. So I'm not doing it for me. It's something for the future, let's say,
Oh,
to
sure.
preserve
Well,
those
that's
memories.
amazing. And do
Yeah.
pears work similar to, I guess maybe, I don't even know if it's all apples or, but I know some are kind of an every other year kind of fruit or
Yeah,
how that
you're
works.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, some biennialism. So some varieties show that strongly, and they'll alternate years. So there's a huge tree behind it here. It's about 140 years old. We call it the Helden tree. Helden being German for a hero.
Okay.
Not because of any kind of weird shit. It's because the
Right.
townland that it's growing in is
Right.
called Helden. So we just call it the Helden tree because I don't know what variety it is, but it only produces every second year.
Okay,
It makes
interesting.
an amazing perry, and I can make like 240 liters from one tree last year, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful tree. But yeah, in fact, our orchard, they're all old trees, and for the past 5 years, they have the entire orchard has started a trend to only fruiting every second year.
Oh, gosh.
They're in sync.
That,
It's really bloody annoying.
huh.
But I can,
Oh,
yeah.
goodness. Yeah. And is that predictable or is that a thing they can just sort of start doing as.
Yeah, I think what kicked us off is we had a late frost 1 year and they killed all the
Okay.
blossom, so then the trees had
Okay.
nothing. And then the following year they compensated because they hadn't fruited the year before. They
Oh,
masses of
wow.
fruit, and I think then they were basically knackered and said. Then the next year
We're
they
done.
didn't even flower. They didn't even blossom,
Yeah.
and then last year was masses of fruit again. So I think that triggered it. But they're also old trees, and old trees can tend to fruit.
Okay, yeah, because my sister-in-law has an old apple orchard in her farm. At the end, these trees are probably sort of 200-ish years old, about the same age as her house. But yeah, they are very every other year, and I suspect they're some kind of cider apple. We don't know, like,
I was
you
going to
wouldn't want to
say,
eat them, but
she's not making cider.
yeah.
She should make
I
cider.
mean, I think
Or
there is a
sorry,
cider
hard cider.
press. I think there is a cider press somewhere on the property, or the remains of one. She's got a ruin that no one has properly poked around at.
You
So
need to send
just,
me photos.
I'll have to get her to go out and take some
Please.
photos of the ruin. Yeah. Yeah.
Find the press. That'd be cool. That'd be cool to do.
I do wonder if that's what's going on, because she's got everything else you would expect. There's trees, there's a spring house, there's what look mill like nearby as well, so it could be there. So
Excellent.
yeah,
Cool.
if we go visit, we'll have to go do some exploration. We just keep going in the winter when
Excavation.
it could happen too, as long as nobody tries to go into the spring house and fall into the water. But you know.
Cool.
Oh goodness. And I understand that I was looking through your Instagram the last year you had an issue with some beavers coming after some of the trees. I wonder, is that an ongoing issue? What do you do about that?
No, that's a very new thing.
Don't know if that's good or bad.
I mean it's nature, and
Right.
when you're planting trees out, I'm really nervous at the moment because I'm due to plant these trees that I've been babysitting for 3 years. I'm due to plant them out this month, and I was nervous about that because we've got deer and we've got hare, and
Right.
voles can sometimes eat the roots of the trees.
Oh
But you know,
gosh,
you do what
yeah.
you can to protect them and
Sure.
whatever. But the beaver, that's new. So we have two small nurseries where all the baby trees are,
Okay.
but they're right at the riverbank at the Shetlands River, same name as the town or the village that I live in. And I knew there were beavers around. I'd seen a dam, and the dam had been removed because of flood risk. But I didn't know where they were. I've never seen a beaver. But yeah, so I was walking the dog, and I went by one of the nurseries and saw some of the tree labels lying on the ground. I was like, that's
oh.
It must have, the wind must have blown them off. And I kind of went to put them back, and I was like, where's the trees?
Oh no.
I really thought it was vandals. I thought like kids had come in and just like cut them, because it was such a clean cut. And I was really upset. And then one of the local hunters, I had posted a photo on WhatsApp, and he said that could be beaver. And I went back and looked, and sure enough, there were little gnaw marks.
Oh my goodness.
It wasn't just so clean a cut. So I was relieved that it wasn't vandalism. It's just nature, and I could live with that. But they ate 40 trees.
Oh my goodness. Wow. They were busy beavers. Yeah.
Very young, 1, 2, and 3 year old trees, quite thin trunks. And you know, they took them off as a light snack in passing.
Oh my goodness.
So I have an electric fence around one. So there was a chap from the county government who is responsible for beaver conservation. And he came by and had looks at it. Yeah, they're active here, and they can provide fences. So I had a sheep fence anyway, which I had put up with no electricity. And he said, electrify it, because they'll go through otherwise. And if they get a shock, they won't come back.
Right. Oh my goodness. Well, I'm glad the trees are protected now, but I guess also glad that the beavers had a little snack.
They have very good tastes. They took the rarest American varieties that have.
Oh no!
Apples. So they preferred the apples. They didn't really eat many pears.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh my goodness. My goodness. I feel like we've only scratched the surface. But Christina, do you have any other questions before we begin to wrap up? Because I feel like, again, there's so much we could really rabbit hole into. Yes.
Yeah, because I feel like anything I ask is going to be really niche, and then we're going to go down another like hour long rabbit hole, because I'm so fascinated with these medieval poems or songs that you found.
Same. And
we will definitely link your article in the show notes.
Yes, because we would buy the monograph.
I need to read that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just saying. Yeah.
That sounds so fascinating.
Yeah, it's
to have, like you said, those little like glimpses into Perry history. So I am so excited to read that.
At least somebody is.
Oh, we're here for it.
And, it is very niche.
Oh, but in the best possible way. And where can I guess within what maybe sort of area can people buy your ciders and Perrys, and should people be making plans to go and visit and maybe pick some up?
Visitors are always welcome. So we tend to sell online and locally. We did export to the UK year before last. A couple of pallets went over. That was very exciting. There's a shop in Frankfurt that sells our stuff, but it's pretty local.
Right.
Very, very small producer, a side job. But look out for other Perrys, because I think any Perry maker deserves support, because it's such a brutal thing to try and make. And if you have a successful Perry, it's worth supporting that, but it's also just worth to have to drink, because it's a really
sure.
Yeah, and like you said, it sounds like there's so many, such a possible variety of flavors, and
we didn't even get into varieties. If you go to a little plug for Fend, the Ross and White Cider Company, for example, go to their website and look through the amounts of Perrys they've got. They do single variety Perrys from old English varieties. I think I already mentioned Little Pomona and Tom Oliver, Greg's Pit. There's go to ciderreview.com.
There we go.
My friend Adam, who I mentioned earlier, has written another plug for him, the book Perry, A Drinker's Guide, coming out in May. He founded Cider Review. He's taking a break, and I've, as of this week, taken over editorship.
Oh, congratulations.
Send people
That's
over,
huge.
And you can read long-form articles about world, Perry, and cider. And I think 900 tasting notes on there now as well. So,
oh, wow.
Really cool.
Really, really get into the broad global tapestry of cider and Perry.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we'll definitely put some links in the show notes, but we'll also make sure that if anyone's heading in that direction, they're checking you out. And
please do.
Yes.
Visitors are always welcome.
Yes, and of course, you know, if you're back in Ireland, of course, we are always happy to take people around. So I know we were saying before we started, we've run into each other at some point, but it's all a bit hazy. So
It'll get hazier.
fair enough, fair enough. Well, we'll leave it there because, again, as we said, there's so much more we could talk about, but we want to make sure people are left wanting more. So thank you, Christina, as always. Thank you, Barry. Folks, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next time. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.